One of the most iconic moments in Olympic history happened almost 50 years ago, and it wasn't on the track or in a pool or ring. It was on the podium at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City.
Back on the track, and yet another record about to be smashed for 200 meters. Smith of America first through the tape. Australia's Norman second. Third, Carlos of the United States. The time, an incredible 19.8. The victory ceremony, unfortunately overshadowed by politics.
At the victory ceremony, John Carlos, the African-American sprinter, raised his fist in the air after winning his medal. It was maybe the most famous Black Power salute ever given. Almost 50 years later, John Carlos remembers the decision, the moment, and the fallout. He told Steve Paulson he was inspired by a meeting with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
I went into the room, and many of the people in the room looked familiar based on what my parents used to see on TV relative to Southern Christian leadership. But yet and still, while I'm sitting there nervously looking to see what's going to take place, I still didn't put the dots together in my mind in terms of where I was or what was about to happen to me in my life. And about 20 minutes later or so, Dr. King walked out of the room. My lip just fell all over the floor in terms of me being in a room with somebody that my mom always revered as God's first lieutenant that he sent here to earth to try and deal with the issues. And here I'm sitting in the room. I'm thinking my mom needs to be a rock in my pocket or a bug on my lapel. She needs to be here. And he noticed right away that I was a little nervous about being in the room. And what I noticed about him is that he was very perceptive and at the same time very comedic. He was a jokester to the point where he cracked so many jokes to relax you. He relaxed me and others in there, I'm sure. And then when we went into the meeting, certain things that he said stuck out in my mind. Like, for instance, he made a statement that they sent a letter to him and told him that he had a bullet with his name on it and he wouldn't have to wait long for it. That stayed in my mind, in front of my mind. The second thing is, probably which was the most important thing relative to the meeting, was the fact that he was going to come out in support of the Olympic boycott. He felt that he didn't want to be in command. He wanted Professor Edwards to be in command, but he definitely wanted to be the support factor right up under Professor Edwards.
And did you support that? I mean, would you have supported a boycott of the Olympics, which would mean that you wouldn't be able to compete there?
That was my game plan to support. But I thought that we would have a unified effort in terms of a staging a boycott. In this meeting, things became crystal clear because Dr. King asked, was there any questions? I had two questions. Quite naturally, the first question would be, Dr. King, if they threaten your life, why would you go back to Memphis if they threaten your life? And I recall I used to wear shades all the time, and they didn't dilate like they do now. And I remember pulling my shades down on my nose so I could look into his eyes. I wanted to see whether this man had any fear for the fact that someone told him that he was getting ready to leave this planet. I saw no fear whatsoever. He was as solid as a rock. And then beyond that, I saw that he had love for humanity. The love that I saw in his eyes was like he said, I didn't make a partial commitment. I made a total commitment. If I have to sacrifice my life for what I believe to be right, then so be it. So I was really struck by that. So I asked him, I said, why would you go back? And he said to me, he said, John, that's a very good question. He said, but I have to go back and stand for those that can't stand for themselves. And John, I have to go back and stand for those that won't stand for themselves. And then as time goes by, you begin to realize those individuals that he was going back to stand up for was the sanitation workers. They wasn't all Black sanitation workers. They wasn't all white sanitation workers. There was a multicultural involvement in the sanitation department at that particular time. And then it leads me farther to believe that Dr. King didn't die as a result of his civil rights activities. He died because he got involved in the economics of this country. So as the people are here at Wall Street, the people here in Wisconsin or Chicago or Boston or wherever, they're concerned about the economics of this country because it's affecting everyone, just the same as Dr. King felt it was affecting the sanitation workers at that time.
Now, of course, the boycott didn't happen, I suppose partly because Dr. King had been killed. No one really took leadership of this boycott.
Well, that was the second question I had to Dr. King. Did you ever play any sports? you play basketball? Did you box? Did you do anything? He said he couldn't shoot pool. My question was, why would you get involved in the Olympic boycott? And he said, John, he said, that's a better question. He said, just imagine you being out in the middle of a lake, and the lake is still and serene. He said, and you reach down and you pull out a rock and you drop it in the lake. He asked me, he said, what happens? I said, it vibrates. He said, yes, it's waves. He said, the waves go out to the far ends of that lake. He said, that Olympic boycott is that rock. He said, if you guys chose to back up, opposed to going to the Olympic Games, he said, would make a statement that would ripple throughout the world as to what would make these individuals step back and give up something that they've trained for all their lives. Something must be wrong. Let's have some sort of dialogue and try and have understanding. But many individuals felt that they've worked so hard to win a gold medal or to win a medal at the Olympic Games. This is something that's embedded into young individuals. You know, the Olympics, go for the gold. You know, it's a glorifying situation. So, therefore, it was very difficult for many of them to say, I'm willing to sacrifice my 15 minutes in the sun. And we felt that we didn't have the right to tell them, you must not go to the Olympic Games. But what we did feel was we had the right to sit them down and let them know both sides of the table in terms of what you're getting in your 15 minutes in the sun and what you could possibly do for humanity, for your kids and your grandkids in terms of making it a better world for all people. But the overwhelming factor is that those individuals felt compelled to go to the Olympic Games. Now, when they decided to go, the question for me was whether I was going to stay home, because I could have quite naturally stayed home. But I felt to myself after thinking about it that had I stayed home, the United States at that time was the greatest country in the world as far as track and field is concerned. Someone from the United States would go and win a medal in my place, get on the victory stand. I really don't believe that they would have gotten up there and represented John Carlos the way he felt he needed to be represented at that time. So I was compelled to go to the games.
So take me to the games. It was you and Tommy Smith were two of the fastest 200-meter runners in the world at that time. There was a good chance you were going to win medals, get up onto the podium.
Well, you know, any great athlete, you know, when I say great, I mean super great. If you're going to have a bad day, God will let you know when you get out of bed that morning that you're going to have a bad day. We had no qualms or no hesitation about us making the team. We knew that we would make the team. And I told Tommy at the quarter semi, after the quarter semi was over, we had a discussion, and I told him I was disenchanted about the fact that the boycott was called off. And I felt like I wanted to make a statement. What's your take on that? He said, I'm with you. From that point on, we started talking about what artifacts we had we could bring to the table, which was the black gloves, which was a black scarf, which I had a black shirt. I had beads. We decided we would wear black socks out there with our pants rolled up. We had no shoes out there. And each and every one of these symbols had a specific meaning. And if you bear me the time, I'll explain them to you. The black glove was based on the fact that we felt with an open fist, there's five people of color, and each one of them are very sharp, have a very strong paradigm as to how things could be better. But either one of them step out on his own to move a pebble, he couldn't move it. But then when you say, all right, the next time we come together and say we have a unified vision as to how we can make things better, such as a possibly a boycott or what have you, and all these people come together in a very powerful force, well, you couldn't move a pebble by yourself. Now, unified, you can move a mountain. That was the concept of the fist and the glove. The scarf on Tommy's neck was to show black pride. I had a black shirt over my USA jersey to indicate that there was sorrow about the fact that we had to go to this extent to get America to wake up and realize its misdeeds in society. Then we decided that the beads that I had on my neck would be for all of the lynchings that had taken place that I've read about and heard about as a young kid coming up in this great country of ours. And then we wore no shoes with long black socks to indicate those individuals that was in the South at that particular time, and I'm sure they're still there today, walking to and from 10, 20 miles to school without shoes. We wore the Puma shoe, or we put the Puma shoe out there merely because the Puma shoe was a shoe that was a concern about people of color that didn't have the means to go out and buy the proper shoes, but they was very kind-hearted to give individual shoes before they even got a reputation.
So you did all this. I mean, it's sort of extraordinary what you're describing. The symbolism there is overpowering. You got the bronze. Tommy got the gold. Peter Norman from Australia got the silver. All up on the podium there. And then when they started playing the Star Spangled Banner, you and Tommy raised
your
fists.
As we walked out, I mentioned to Tommy that, hey, man, you remember when we go out there, I said, people are going to be applauding, and then there's going to be a void, and that void would be total silence because they would be in a state of shock once we started to perform our deeds. And at the same time, I told Tommy, remember, we've been threatened. Our lives have been threatened. So remember this, man.
Well, why had you been threatened?
Well, based on the fact that we was proposing an Olympic boycott. They felt it was anti-American, you know, and many of the haters out there didn't particularly like the fact that you would step back. They feel that, oh, we giving you this honor. No, you didn't give me an honor. You set a standard. I took the honor to step up and qualify to make the Olympic team. I want America to represent young individuals in regards to what their ethnic background is as much as these young individuals honor America. That's what our stand was then. That's what my stand is today. So when we went out there, I told Tommy, be careful, man. We've been trained to listen to the gun. If you hear the gun, hit the deck. We went out there. We put the shoe down on the victory stand as they acknowledged us. Tommy, I believe, raised his glove and the shoe on his foot up to the spectators. And then when we received our medals and we turned to the right to the flag and they started to sing the national anthem, and then we come out with the gloves and raise our fist to the sky. And it's just like I said, this void came over to the point where it was silent for a matter of seconds. And then it went from silence to total screaming of the national anthem. It's almost like they were singing the national anthem in a sense that we're going to shove this American national anthem down your throats whether you want it or not.
And then you got booed, right?
Oh, it was a tremendous amount of boos.
What was the fallout for you personally? I mean, for starters, just as an athlete, weren't you kind of ostracized by the track and field establishment?
Well, I was ostracized to a sense, you know, but I wasn't weak enough that they could run me away. I decided that I was going to run for 2 years, and I always thought about how they tried and slammed down our throats that national anthem, and I wanted to slam down their throats that I was going to be the best in the world. Anybody you bring, I was going to wear them out for you to let them know I'm here to run, and I'm here for anybody you want to bring against me. But yet and still, you know, I had aches and pains relative to the demonstration. I would say that probably the most important thing that was most hurting or disturbing to me was my first wife took her life as a result of the Olympics, the pressures that were put upon us, the lack of money into our household, the contempt that came into our household.
No, and you should elaborate on that because, I mean, reading your book, the FBI followed you.
Oh,
they would plant rumors about you. You
put
got
rumors
death
out.
Threats.
Well, it's no different than what they do today to anyone. They did the same thing to Dr. King. And then at the same time, my kids had to endure our ridicule in school merely because when the teachers found out they were my kids. So I had to endure all of these things. I remember I had to get $100 here, $200 there, and get somebody to drive me to Vegas just so I could roll the dice to pay my mortgage. 29 days out of the month. If it was 30 days, I'm working 29 days to get my mortgage payment so my kids wouldn't live in the street. And I remember chopping up my furniture, taking my kids and tell them, take your clothes out of the bureau drawer and put it on the floor there. And I would go take a claw hammer and chop that furniture up and go put it in the fireplace because I could not pay my electric bill. I didn't have groceries. I had some dear friends that came and said, John, I don't have much, but I see you don't have nothing in your cabinets and came and put food in my house. Many individuals walked away from me at that particular time that I thought was my friends. It took me a minute to find out that they walked away not because of disrespect or dislove. The majority of them walked away for fear of reprisal. If you was associated with John Carlos, what's happening to him can come and happen to you as well.
Did you ever have any regrets for what you did
back
in Mexico City?
No regrets whatsoever. And if it was necessary for me to step up tomorrow, I would never hesitate to step up for what I feel is right. People say, you sound like you still running. Sound like you still got the fire. Well, the fire was with me when I came. The fire being with me when I left until justice is brought here for all men, women, and children on this planet. Someone has to step up in order to make it better. What good is my life being here? If I'm here and I got kids and grandkids coming into this world and I'm in a position where I could bring attention to something to try and make us solve this problem or make it a better situation, and now I'm getting ready to leave and I haven't done anything to try and make a better life for my kids or their kids. That's what it's about.
Thank you. Thank
right
you.
On.
John Carlos held his fist high after winning the bronze in the 200 meters at the Olympics in Mexico City in 1968. His memoir is called The John Carlos Story. Steve Paulson talked with him.